The joy for me is I get to chat to some of the most delightful people it's been my pleasure and privilege to work with. And I'm absolutely thrilled today. I walked through Covent Garden with a particular memory of more years ago than either of us should own up. We were rehearsing Mother Courage for a day at the Adelphi, and a very lovely lady took me shopping into Penhaligon's, and that's cost me a lot of money over the years. That very lovely lady was the fragrant, delightful, gorgeous, and uniquely talented Zoe Wanamaker.
Thank you.
I always start, a bit boringly, but by going right back to, was there a moment when you thought, that's what I want to do, that got you here to where you are today?
I don't remember a moment, but my mother, when we lived in... I was born in New York, and we had a nanny called Aggie, and Aggie used to take me to church. And there was a lot of genuflecting around, and I thought this was really cool, apparently. So I think that must have been... It was very theatrical, incense and lots of stuff. And I think apparently I came home genuflecting a lot. That must have been the moment. I don't know. I can't pick it. There was another time when Dad was... my father was Sam Wanamaker, and he was playing Iago at Stratford with Paul Robeson playing Othello, and we rented a cottage. They rented a cottage out there, and it was one of the most romantic... idyllic experiences I ever had. Daddy used to row to work on the Avon every morning. And I think it was going backstage and smelling the size, which they used to seal the canvases with, and smelling that and seeing actors who were always glamorous and ruffled and sexy. And I think that was it. It was that smell of size and grease paint that made me really want to be an actor. I think that's it. It looked so glamorous. Little did I know.
Were your parents a bit worried? Because obviously they must have known how precarious it could be.
Mm.
And in fact... I think, did they persuade you, or were you persuaded to go and do other routes before you eventually went to train? And
yes. When I left school, I really wanted to be an actor, but my parents were very, quite rightly, nervous of this. So I went to art school for a year. I went to Hornsey, because I could draw quite well, and I went to Hornsey College of Art for a year, to try and find another artistic route on which I could put my energies to, but I wasn't good enough. I just couldn't find... The wonderful thing about Hornsey was that that first year, you could try every form of art, be it industrial design, be it fashion, be it silversmithing, be it... clay work, pottery. So I discovered that I wasn't really... it's a very solitary business, being an artist. And I didn't like to work by myself. I found that very frustrating. And that's when I really decided that I wanted it to be a... I wanted to work as an actor that on a collaborative basis, not by myself in a terrible old studio. So that's when I decided that I wanted... I said, no, I don't want to do that. I can't do that. I'm not good enough. I want to be an actor. And my parents then said... Well, my mother said, if you want to be an actress, then you have to learn to do shorthand and typing, because you'll be out of work a lot. So I did something called speed writing, which I saw in the tube. It said, get a good job fast in 3 months. Well, I got there, and I was there for 6 months. Then I started working in offices, ending up in a casting director's office, as a gopher, really. And I nearly didn't do it because it was the most humiliating thing, watching actors coming in to audition for a film or something and them not looking like their photograph, them not being quite right. What happened was that the casting director once gave me a script and said, this is a script, I've got to go away, go through Spotlight, I want you to cast Vanessa Redgrave's friend in a film called Isadora. So I went through Spotlight and I went through, oh, she looks good, she looks interesting, she looks good. And then she took me all day to do this. And then she came back and she went, no, oh, I haven't seen her for ages. Oh, okay. No, it was the most, I didn't realize it was like that. It put me right off. But I applied to drama school and got into the first one that accepted me.
Which was Central.
Central School of Speech and Drama.
And how important do you think training was for you? And do you think it's still that important? There's a big debate going on now about the expense of training and about the only people who can afford to do it are people who come from rich middle-class families, and we're going to exclude a whole range of people having access to drama training. Is it absolutely vital? And what did it give you?
Well, for me, it was... I was always on time, which I hadn't been before. But it was... It's a sort of... I suppose it's... For me, personally, it was it was like a university. So that when somebody goes to university or goes to... There is a time when you actually have to realize what is involved physically and vocally and mentally of being an actor, the commitment of being an actor. Your instrument is your body and your voice and what you do. And for me, it was very important. But the doing is the most important. But then I was at, and we were at a time when there were repertory theatres all over the country. And there are no longer those sort of things to go to where you would do... You'd join for about 6 months, 9 months, and you do play after play after play. Now, actors don't have that luxury, because it was a luxury. So it's a different thing. You know, acting, being an actor is, for me, is a craft. It is... You never stop learning. You never stop... being presented with new things that you perhaps have never done before, and the muscles have to be ready. You have to be like a juggler. You have to be able to do anything. If you can play an instrument, that's even better. If you can sing, that's even better. So all those muscles have to be used, because this is a long-term... It's not just... It's a career. It's a life. It's a way of life. It was good for me, and I was dying to start work, But I got lucky. So now it's a different thing. Now there's you know, you've got YouTube, you've got la la la, you've got la 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 la. So it's harder to start working and using all that information that you've trained for 3 years, which it was then. And you tackled text, and you tackled poetry, and you learnt to use your ribcage and your brain. And now it's actors have to... Well, they've got to put a roof over their heads. And so now they have to be able... We as performers, have to find another passion, another joy that we can earn money by. Because it's such an ephemeral business. Everybody's freelance now. I mean, when I was starting, people were saying, oh, you're going to be an actor. That's really, really scary. Or, you know. But now everybody's freelance. So we're not alone as actors. So I don't know. I just know that there are a few people who I've met who never trained. And... later in life they wish they had. For instance, I was just telling Paul, there's an actress, an Indian actress that I know who never trained, has never done Shakespeare, who rang me up and said, I've been asked to play Lady Macbeth and I don't know what iambic pentameter is. I don't know, where do I go? And I said, I don't know how to help you because I'm not really good either. And I suggested if there was something that was going on at the Actors' Centre, maybe she could find somebody there. Or if she's, there's a... So I said, and she said, what books do I read? I said, you don't read books. You have to do. You have to feel that there's a muscularity in the language. So therefore, she is like at a place where she suddenly discovers halfway through her life that she has never been... She's never done that bit. And that's not only exciting, but it's fucking terrifying. So I don't know. I don't think it's up to middle classes to go to drama school. I think it's if you can, it's harder now to find money and then to be able to live in London or wherever.
And the traditional route, as you said, of being an actor and training, and although people do train actors in television more these days, it was mainly always a theatre-based training that what we did best, because training in television uses additional equipment and expense.
Yes.
And then you went out into the theatre, and you went out into rep.
Yeah.
What was the? Can you remember what was the most outlandish thing you played in rep? Because the great thing was that they used to employ us in a company, and then it'd be dishing out the parts between everybody, so you could be doing things that you'd be quite unsuitable for.
Mm.
I mean, I remember being a West Country servant, which should never have happened.
Probably very good.
No, let me tell you. No,
outlandish. I played a cat in Dick Whittington.
Okay.
In Edinburgh, the Lyceum, Richard Eyre was running the Lyceum then, and I played a cat, and I had a big cat suit. That's when I first learned about upstaging. Nobody ever told me about that bit. And I had to sit on Una McLean's knee. She was a very little person. And then she sang a song to me about old pals. And as she was singing, she put her hand right in front of my face. Old pals. And the guy who was playing the crab told me, do you know that you've been up there? And I thought, no, what's that? So, in my cat suit, I developed pockets. And I had a pipe. And I used to whistle. So I thought, no, I'm going to learn how to upstage, and that's when I used to walk along the back. So that was the most outlandish thing I did.
Okay. So it not only gave you challenges, but it extended your range of talents.
It certainly did.
Good. And I bet you've never used that particular talent since, have you?
No.
No.
But I learnt it.
Brilliant. And then, I suppose when we were in the theatre, I certainly know mine was doing rep. You aimed to then join one of the large companies, like the RSC or the National, because it seemed a natural progression. I don't think many of us thought, and now I need to do television.
No.
It was theatre, and if television filled in...
That's right. Yeah.
We were thrilled, but we thought we were doing well if we were doing theatre. And you, mid-70s, joined the RSC...
Joined the RSC in 1976, doing The Devil's Disciple with Tom Conti and John Wood and Bob Hoskins. And then I went on to do Ivanov there, which was a wonderful experience. And then I did another play, which doesn't come to mind, and then we went into Piccadilly.
And then you went to, and then eventually you went and did the cycle and went to Stratford.
Then
a couple
in
of years
78,
later.
I went to Stratford. That's the first time I went there.
What did it feel like suddenly joining a really big company and being part of the ensemble? And of course, you'd also been there as a girl. You were telling us. When your dad was...
Oh, yes. I've gone off. Stratford was... Yeah, that was before the RSC was really formed. Peter Hall changed it completely. So when Dad was working there, it was just
the Memorial Theatre.
Just the Memorial Theatre. So going to Stratford was, for me, was a bit like Mecca, because you got to have sonnet sessions with John Barton. You had classes with Sis Berry, voice and poetry with her. It was like a conservatoire, you know, conservatoire. And also, it was away from London. It was concentrated. And it was a wonderful experience to have, very exciting. It was also the first kind of punk company that had been at Stratford. So it was a new generation of actors coming in. Jonathan Pryce, Paolo Dionisotte, David Suchet, who'd been there a bit longer, Richard Griffiths. It was a marvellous company. Chris, am I all right? I'm doing something funny. Can you hear me? Yep.
I think it might be just leaning back.
Oh, right. So that was a very enriching and rewarding job.
Did you like it, being part of a big team? You said that was what you were looking for as
very
an actor,
so.
To work with
it
other people.
It was a great team as well, Ian Charlson. And then we did Piaf there as well, with Jane, and that. And then we did Once in a Lifetime, which came to the Aldwych, and we opened that, and that was a big success. Piaf and Once in a Lifetime were major successes.
Yeah. And then you've also done quite a lot at the National, so you like that big company ethos.
Yeah. I just like it's a. It's about, for me, it's about... It's a terrible cliche to say, but it's about telling... Not telling stories, that's really... But it's about doing great plays, great language, and working together as a team to, in order to present that to you, to an audience. And involving oneself in one's craft and learning that, and being able to use one's body and voice and also to use one's imagination and to do it together is a joy. When it works well, I call it hovercrafting. You just kind of lift off and you're all one together. You all have a focus, and that's joyous.
So do you feel you have that in television? Because by this time you'd started doing some television. You did Paradise Postponed, the big John Mortimer extravaganza.
Yeah.
With a very big cast. Huge. And a big ensemble. Mm.
That was great. I mean, it was also a great piece of writing. I think what I've always tried to do is go for good writing. The texts have to be interesting and fire my imagination, and that's what I always tried to do. I tried to go for the parts, always go for the parts, and always go for the writing, and then the director after that. Going to the National was a different animal, because you're only cast for one play, and whereas at the RSCA it's three, if you can handle it. And for the RSCA at that time, it was a year's contract going into another year at that point, because at that time you're at Stratford, and then you used to come into the Aldwych, then it turned into the Barbican. And now that's no longer. So it's a completely different world now. I mean, we're talking 30 years ago. So it's got to change. I mean, things have to change.
Yeah.
And it's exciting that it has to change, but you have to keep on your toes.
What's the favourite thing you've done at the National? You've done some great things. Gwendolyn, and in fact, my last guest, Alex Jennings.
Yes.
You and he did His Girl Friday, the version of The Front Page. And you played Ranovskaya, which was beamed around the country in national live.
Yes. Well, all of them were great. All of them. The Much Ado, which I did with Simon and Nick Heitner, which was great. They're all massively enjoyable. David Hare double bill that I did at the, and then Mrs. Klein. I mean, I've done a lot there.
You get quite a luxurious rehearsal period at the RSC and the National. Mm. Do you like that? Do you enjoy it? Does the work fill that? Or would you prefer to make it more compact and then get on and develop it in performance?
No. I like that long rehearsal so that you can ease into it. It takes time. I like that, and that you can all work it out and gnaw it out and spit it out, and then slowly then you put it in front of the audience, and then you get the fourth person who's never been in rehearsal, and then you start experimenting with that. Once you've got the basis of what you're doing and why you're doing it, who you are and what you want, then you can start sharing it. And that's the joy. When you're working on television, you get no rehearsal anymore. You get no time to assimilate. It's another lonely business, actually, interestingly enough. It is like being an artist, because you have to create it by yourself very quickly. I think that's why a lot of American actors do, we were talking about this, keep working, keep going to class, keep going, particularly when they're not working, they go to classes all the time, they do scenes, they try and improvise, I mean, they keep that muscle working. It's not a disgrace to go back to school, because without that you lose some kind of impetus in what you're doing and where your energy is, and what you lose faith in what you can do as a human being, or what you're trained for. And that's been interesting working in New York. The difference between American actors and British actors is quite remarkable.
So there's a perception that we Brits pop down our gin and tonic and then just step on and do it and pop back and have a drink, while the Americans rack their emotions and their inner soul and get into the zone before they step on. You're a dual citizen.
I'm an American.
But you pay taxes in both countries, yes?
So, yes, but I've been brought up.
So which way do you fall then in the performance? Are you a get on and do it, or are you a method and
a bit of everything, really? I try and do anything I can.
Throw everything.
Because it all adds up. Sometimes I find that things are too quick. For instance, something like My Family, which I had never done a sitcom before, and I thought, well, I've never done that before, let's try that. That was rigorous, because you do a new episode every week, and you only had 4 days to learn it, or maybe Friday. Yes, only, well, 6 days to learn it over the weekend, and it had to be done on Thursday. You get an audience, and then on Friday you get a new script. So sometimes that's more rigorous. You get rehearsal, but then the scripts are not necessarily good. They're not necessarily characterful. They're not necessarily clever, and sometimes the writing has to be changed and you have to accommodate that, or sometimes they just haven't written anything to do with how you've thought of your character or developed your character. So that is hard. So you have to make time for yourself in order to do that. And sometimes you have to do an improv in your head of the situation to find out how you could fit that in. So that's double work that you're doing.
Do you think the fact that you... Because I came in for a week, 4 years apart in My Family, and you made me laugh. But I was amazed after a week that I went away and then you were doing the whole process again the next week. Mm. But you and Robert Lindsay brought an incredible amount of performer's integrity to it. Do you think that was part of its success? That it wasn't just, we'll do the script and it can all be blamed on the script, that you really did wrestle with it and say, we need something else and we'll turn it. Mm. Because it ran for 11 years, 10 years, 11, over 100 episodes. Yeah,
122 episodes. I think it was I think it's with the initial scripts that were, when we first started, were written by an American. And it had a kind of wit and a ironic humor, which is not was not particularly English. It's usually English humor was... Irony was not their strong point. It's usually about slightly crash, bang, wallop. It's a bit in your face. It's set up joke, set up a gag. And this was much more cleverly written and had something about it. As it went on, it developed. The American left, and then we started to get the writers got bigger and more and more. Got more and more. We had a football team at one point, and that's when it started to not work. And they were trying to do it on the American model, where there's a big team of writers constantly working on that. And it just got distilled, I think. So therefore, the ideas weren't as quick and as fast enough. What was the question?
No, it was just that thing about that in the middle of it, I think you did take it and hold on to it and say, this is Susan. I know Susan because I've done this. And and Robert was doing the same at the centre of it for Ben. So coming in as an actor to work with you, yes, there were gags and things, but you were demanding a reality so that we weren't watching a cardboard cutout family. We did actually see people who had emotions, but... who were funny.
Yeah. I don't know. The only thing I can think of is that Ben and Susan had great sex, which is which is unusual in a sitcom. I don't think
I think I missed that episode.
But you know, it's about a couple who have three children and still have a...
It gave you that it gave you that supermarket attention factor. Right back in the early 90s, you did Love Hurts with Adam Faith, which was a brilliant series that took the nation by storm. And we didn't have Twitter or Facebook and everything, but people were talking about, is she going to leave him? Is she going to, tune in 9:30 BBC One? And that was a massive leap in that, suddenly you're shopping in whatever named supermarket is your choice.
No, I was walking down the street. It was a car accident. I saw a car accident because somebody had done a double take. Gone straight into some other car. I mean, and that was really embarrassing. My whole ethos is about being an actor is that you should go through life incognito only because you can't observe if somebody knows if you're famous or infamous because you can't absorb reality in any other way. So I'm very shy of it because of that very reason. So it was a bit of a shock when that happened. I pretend it's not going on.
All right. So then I suppose you can get back to the comfort of the theatre, which you've done reasonably regularly between those big television things.
Yeah.
You did a brilliant recently. You were with David Suchet in All My Sons. And, of course, I'm doing this entirely from a personal point of view. You popped into Poirot and you've created Ariadne Oliver, who on the page probably isn't half as fabulous and sexy.
On the page, she's extremely funny. And when David asked me to do... Agatha Christie had got really bored of writing Poirot and tried to kill him a lot. And her publishers wouldn't let her do that. So she created the antithesis of Poirot, who was a sort of a send-up of herself. And so she created this extraordinary character. And when I started to read the stories in which Ariadne came in, there are about 8 to 10 stories that she wrote. The conversations between Poirot and Agatha and Ariadne were, some of them are hysterically funny, and it was a joy to play her because she, I think Agatha Christie is a genius, actually. I really do, and so I became really in love with her, with Ariadne, because she was, whereas Yeah, the antithesis of Poirot, whereas he is meticulous and a pain in the bum and very careful about everything, just like David in many ways. I'm perfect casting because I'm completely messy, and we work very well together, and we're very fond of each other, which is good.
So one thing you did at the National was you played Gwendolyn.
Yes.
To Judy Dench's Lady Bracknell.
Yes.
And there's probably quite a lot of people thinking, is there a Lady Bracknell coming? But David Suchet's got there first.
Oh,
next
yeah.
year he's going to play Lady Bracknell. So what do you think about all these, you know, these men taking women's roles?
Bollocks, really. No. It's fine. It's fine. Let's just do it, you know. I mean, it's fine.
Is there a male role you'd love to play?
No.
No?
No, I haven't. No, I haven't read enough or seen enough to make me think I'd like to play that.
And coming right up to date, you're going to be back on our screens in Mr. Selfridge.
Oh, Mr. Selfridge, sorry.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, I just remembered. Yes, I'm doing Mr. Selfridge, which I had never seen. So that was good. I enjoyed that. I'd never seen it. They presented me with this extraordinary character who I did an actual person who I saw. I did a lot of research on her, and I thought that was going to be fun. Which it was.
And that starts after Christmas, I think.
I think that starts February.
Yeah.
Something like February. Yeah.
So, before we hand over to people for their questions, totally unfiltered, and we'll see how we get on, given the fact that very early on in your career, I'm told, you eschewed the idea of becoming a nun.
It's good for a Jew, isn't it? I was 10, for God's sake.
Okay. What would you have done if you hadn't been an actor?
I have no idea. Something to do with the art business, I think. Definitely, because I did have a very wonderful time at Hornsey in that 10 months that I did there. I still have a massive respect for painters and artists, creative. So I think I might have done something like that, something to do with painting.
Has it stayed part of your life? Do you do any painting? Or?
No, my drawings are stick people now. It's something like anything. You have to practice. This is what I'm talking about. Going to the Actors Centre you just have to keep that muscle going. Or learning the piano. If you don't practice, it falls away from you. But I still go to art galleries, and I still enjoy certain people, some friends who are painters and potters, and I still love that world tremendously.
Wow. Shall we hand over to see what we get? Have we got a roving mic person? We have. Lovely. So this is the moment of embarrassed silence where we go, who has a question? And we are very great. Oh, look, hands flying up today. So Katrine is going to come to you with a microphone, and then we should be able to hear you. Let's go there in that row first.
Oh, you have to hold it, okay. Hello, Zoe.
Hello.
How are you? Good afternoon. It might be deemed an ambiguous question, but I'd like you to comment on, if you may, on how the acting world has changed since you first started. Do you think it's a better place, a better world, environment? How has it changed? Is it for the better or for the worse? Or where do you see it going ultimately as well?
I don't know where I see it going. Where I see it going. The difference is that for me, the sadness is the death or the demise of rep for actors to be able to practice their craft, learn mistakes, make mistakes. But there is another animal called television and the internet. And also actors, I think are have to be much, much more flexible now, much more be able to bob and weave, or find their, which is what we all try and do in life anyway, is just find what they're good at. And that's a struggle for people who aren't employed. And so it has to be, we now, actors now have to really want to do what they want to do, but they also have to want to find to do something else. As I said earlier, you've got to be able to find something else that you can make money with, that you can get your rocks off some other place, because if that doesn't, you know, you've got to get found, be fed and not feel, it's keeping your self-esteem and your self-respect, and that's constant. I think that's always been that. I don't think it's changed in any way, in that way. I don't know where it's going. The thing is, it's alive and well and kicking, and here we are. And there's lots of good stuff going on and on the fringe, and there's lots of new writing coming out. There's lots of young women, thank God, writers coming out, which is fantastic. So it's not dead at all. I think it's very much alive and very exciting.
Great. Okay. Let's go there, because that makes Katrina walk not very far, and then we'll send her to the back on the next trip.
Hello. Do you have a mentor or a coach? For example, if you had a new thing, you would just do it on your own.
I don't have a coach.
Okay.
I've always... when I was doing a film called My Week with Marilyn, with Michelle Williams, she had a drama coach with her. It was a bit like art reflecting life, because I was playing her drama coach, Paula Strasberg, who was Lee Strasberg's wife. And this was very interesting. This is where I was very jealous, very envious, because if a director, particularly on film, if a director can't speak to an actor, doesn't know how an actor has a process, because, I mean, we're all different anyway, but it can't help you, then who do you go to? And Michelle had this woman whispering in her ear the whole time, which made the director really pissed off and alienated, which is absolutely exactly what happened to Laurence Olivier on the film Prince and the Showgirl. Then I discovered that Andy Garfield had this woman also with him on set all the time when he was making movies. So this is a norm in America. Because usually the director is really about his shots and the special effects, and there's nothing going on that can give an actor juice. So I wish I don't know anybody, anything. I do most of it by instinct, and a lot of it by sitting with the script a lot, reading a lot. I go to art galleries to find some, listen to music, all kinds of music. Now, because I have dyslexia, so it takes me much longer to absorb a script. So I've found somebody who can help me, who's nothing to do with the business at all, who happens to be quite bright, so I talk to her. And through talking and learning the lines and working with her, I've found it. But she's not an actor's mentor by any means. I wish there were one in this country. I can't hear. She's helping me, but she's not saying, she's not unlocking bits of imagination. But she's, fuck me, she's helping. If I didn't have her, I don't know.
Brill. Let's go nearer the back if we can. Anybody, there we go, further down that side. Or you might have to go down the middle, Katrina. We'll wait.
There was a lady.
Make the decision.
There.
And then there's a lady over there.
Somewhere.
Fantastic.
Hello. God, that sounds really in my eyes.
I know, I can see.
you may not agree with this because you're a very humble performer, but when did you realise that you were funny? Did you have a moment when you were like, actually, like, I'm pretty damn funny?
Well, my mother thought I was funny. So, you know, that's the problem when you leave home and then you go to people who don't think you're funny. You know, it's a bit of a... So... I don't know when I thought I was funny. I would think... I can pin it down, actually. When I first worked with Howard Davis on Piaf, which was a play written by Pam Jems, which Jane Lapater played Piaf, and I played her half-sister, Twan, who was basically a prostitute. And that was 1978, and it was the first time I'd worked with a director who gave me a focus. So I forgot what I was doing. You know, I was always worried about what I do with my hands, doing that a lot, you know, holding your inner self away, hiding that bit. And then he started to give me a focus, and then he'd laugh. He'd laugh at me being funny. And I think that's when I first discovered that was funny, apart from my mother. So I think that was it. That must have been, and that was what, 8 years out of drama school, took me that length of time. I suppose, yeah. Thank you.
Wow. And you still are.
Funny, what?
You still are.
Thank you.
Next question. Any questions up there? Hands up. Down, right down the front here. Sorry. I'm making you work.
Hello. What would your biggest piece of advice be with regards to actors and agent, their agent?
Ooh, actors and their agents.
Actors and their agents. Well, interesting enough, I've been with my agent now 90%, the same agent, 90% of my whole working life. I left this particular agent and went to somebody else, and then she took me out for lunch and she had the worst hat on in the world. And I thought, I can't have an agent like that. Where's a hat like that? So I left her and I went back to the one I'd had before. I think you have to... somebody said to me, an agent is like a post office. They receive the information and then they post it out to you. I think you have to have a good relationship. You have to be an honest one. I think you have to like them, is one thing. And because they have to be your friend to some extent, they're the ones who put you up for jobs. They're the ones who suggest you for jobs. They can't do anything else. That's the thing. They can only get your foot in the door, and then it's up to you. It's asking them to get their foot in the door. That's sometimes the problem. I went to, you know, when I first went to this particular agency, it was small. It was very small. They only had about 70 clients at the time. Now they're much bigger than that. I prefer to have a smaller agency because I know I can pick up the phone and I can speak straight to my agent. Then there's other agents here. I nearly went to another agency, which is massive. And, you know, it's like Fort Knox trying to get in. And there's secretaries who don't know the fuck you are, don't know how to spell your name. So I didn't want to go there. Maybe that was a mistake.
Do you think there's any difference between women and men as agents?
Yeah. No, I don't think there's any difference.
Women.
I don't think so. I don't think there's a difference. I don't know, because I've never been to any other agency.
Well, that's good. It obviously works then, doesn't it?
Yeah, but then, you know, there's a kind of a strata as well with agents, you know. You know, like the big agencies who have reps in L.A. and New York and stuff like that. Those are very important. But, you know, I don't want to be a lemming and go out to pilot season and sit there and twiddle my thumbs and... What for? It's too humiliating.
Yeah.
It's the rejection. I don't know. It's how actors have to deal with rejection. And that's the most important thing. I think the most important thing, changing the subject a little bit, is working for that casting director was the most important piece of... a very important experience for me, because it taught me that it's not necessarily how good or bad you are, it's whether you're right for it, and it's whether it's all to do with chemistry, it's to do with the chemistry between the actor, between the director and the script, and what their vision is, what the director's vision is, and also the chemistry between two other actors and how they'll work together. So it's all about creating something. So it's not necessarily your fault if you don't get the job. It's about it may not work with another person that thinks it. So it's, you have to be nicer to yourself to say you have to be nice.
It's hard though, isn't it, when the phone rings and they do say no.
You're lucky if you get the phone call.
Well, these days, yeah, absolutely. There, right in the middle on this side. Now, I was just thinking that whenever I've had a male agent and a female agent, and you ring up at 2 minutes past 2, the female agent is always back from lunch.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And the male isn't.
And the male agent's, oh, he's out for lunch with a client. And you think, well, not me.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Hi.
What was your most satisfying role on leaving drama school? Yeah, that suggested to you that you felt like you were going in the right direction.
Oh, gosh.
Oh, what was your most satisfying role at drama school that was suggested you were going? Was there something you did at drama school that clicked and you thought...
After drama school?
After drama school.
Oh. Gosh. I liked the cat. let me see. I loved doing The Cherry Orchard, which I first did at the Edinburgh Lyceum. It was really a great opportunity to... I'd done it before. I'd played this character before in a little theatre called the Stables Theatre in Manchester, mm-hmm. 1970. Bleh. And then when I was asked to do it again with Richard Eyre up at the Lyceum. And having done it and made mistakes... worn false eyelashes, shit like that, and I realised that this was a much better way of doing it. That was a very satisfying experience for me. There were many along the way where you just think, oh, this is really what it's why I'm here, and you're, as I said earlier, you're constantly trying to look for that. When there's a book called Zen and the Art of Archery, which is all about the target is you and you are the target, so you are one. So when that happens, when you become this character and it's seamless, that's what you look for. So in every part I've played, I've gone for that. And if it doesn't happen, there's something wrong with me. But there's so... I would think, actually, the pinnacle of it was, I suppose, Electra, which I did a while ago. And that, for me, was a very visceral experience, which I'd never had before. It took me a long time, hadn't it? That was 2000 and something. I can't remember when it was. But, yeah, that was, I think, another one. And I also loved doing, interesting enough, passion play was Peter Nichols' play.
Yeah.
Was and then, of course, all my... I mean, I could go on. They've all been deeply important.
Do you get more fulfilled from being on stage, do you think? Do you think you've worked more when you come off stage at the end of an evening than when perhaps you've done a day's filming?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, I do think that the theatre does give you that space, and there's something magical about working in a space which and bringing all your intellect and everything to a character. It's less easy in film because everything is so minuscule, and you do it piecemeal. So it's not as gratifying, and that's why I think a drama coach is really nice. Sitting there going, now remember you could do this.
Yeah. Fab. Let's just go back from where you are, Katrina, and then we'll come down here, and then I think we're heading to...
Hi.
My
name is Nico, and I would like to talk about the accent. Do you believe a foreigner who is in England and trying to be an actor should keep his accent for the beginning and then change to a British or American, or should from the beginning start fighting with changing his accent and then get into theater and everything?
You're never going to lose your accent. That's you, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's you.
Yeah, that's what I believe, but most of people are telling me that you have to start changing from now.
Mm. I think if you can... You'll get more work if you can do everything. If you can change your accent, then that's great. There's nothing wrong with that. But
even if I changed, even if a foreigner changed his accent, he'll never be as good as a British accent actor.
Yes.
Right? Because, of course, never you're going to change to the best, but... Do you believe that you should try to do it? Or?
I think you should try and be more articulate. If you're more articulate with your English, which is obviously a completely... what's the word? You're bilingual. If you can make your English accent... your accent more articulate so that it's your own accent... is slightly is used to speak English so that we can understand you properly. I think that's what you need it for. But it's being articulate, I think. Which you
lots
learn
of,
drama
there's
school.
Lots of wonderful people whose English, whose standard English, is coloured
by their, accent,
their
like
original
you.
Accent. Like me,
yes.
Well, like Burton,
yeah.
Hopkins and people, and
yeah.
There's a colour... And actually, the bland accents which are trained are probably the least attractive. These days, on lots of people's CVs, you find RP and a little asterisk next to it saying native. I want to know where they come from. Where is this town, RP? Because it's called received pronunciation,
yeah.
i.e. pronunciation you have received. So I would say absolutely, yeah. Mm. And it's part of you,
exactly.
But use it to colour your English.
Yes.
We had another question over there, and we have one down there, and then I think we'll be heading to a close. So let's take one over there, please, Katrina.
Did that help at all? Yeah.
You've got a thumbs up. Look, there you go. Oops.
And look at her, I like the
we're
wind
on time
cheese,
for 2 o'clock. We're going to take this lady here, and I think
Hello.
That'll probably have to be the last.
My name's Katarina. Can I just add very quickly something to what the gentleman just asked?
Mm.
I'm actually from Germany. I trained in England, and I worked on my English so hard that nobody else actually usually thinks I am German. So I think you should really work on it, and then he can play the English parts. That's just what I wanted to add. Like, if you go to the great, voice teachers... I think that really helps. Like, if you just listen to people, listen to your English friends, and just try to listen to yourself every day, then you should be fine. Like, you can get rid of it. Like, I don't mean rid of it. Like, you can still put it back on if you wanted to. And I think that can be very handy as well.
Good.
So, I agree. I agree. If you really want to change it,
yeah,
you've got to really work at it.
Yeah. No, it's a good skill, to have something else. But my question, actually, was, is there a favourite play or part that you would really, really like to do still, even if it's a part that where you think this is maybe not your age anymore, or this is not your age yet, or this is completely against your casting? Is there something that you really would like to do?
Something on your bucket list, something you'd like to do.
I don't have them, because I think if I wish for something, it'll go away. I don't want to do that now, but I would love to have played Juliet, because I think I knew... Mm. Know how it should be done, but I'm way too old now. But I wish I'd had that opportunity then. But I wasn't a pretty thing then. I was always playing rubbish parts.
And you played a piece of stretched skin in Doctor Who.
Yes, that was challenging. Yes,
challenging but fun. Okay, I'm very aware of time, so I'm sorry if there are more questions. I just want to ask you one thing, because obviously we've talked, and you bring a great deal of pleasure and joy to people through your work. And I know that one thing that when the Globe opened, which was your dad's vision, you were the first person to officially speak on the stage of the Globe Theatre. How was that?
Well, it was very emotional. Mark Rylance, who was then the artistic director, suggested that I do the opening chorus speech from Henry V. And it was very frightening. And the Queen was there. And it was very emotional, because my dad hadn't lived to see the Queen come up on the barge from on the Thames, like Elizabeth I, and get out and be there at the completed Globe. So it was... I had to take a Valium. It just was... It was just too much. It was too heavy. I mean, it was great. You know, and it still is great just to go there and see, you know, exactly what he had predicted happened to the South Bank there, what he wanted and what he'd dreamed of and what he had said was going to happen. He said, this place is going to explode. And he told me to buy a flat round there. I said, no, I can't do that. I mean, it's a different place from when I was there.
Yeah.
And now the Sam Wanamaker Playhouse has opened, which is a delightful theatre. Really beautiful. Yeah. Anyway.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Well, it just gives me the chance to say thank you, not only for today, but for, and as I think we've had a glimpse this afternoon, all the laughter, because you do have one of the dirtiest laughs,
That's true, I have to say.
Yeah. I'm sorry, it has to be remarked on, that you've given me on the many times we've worked together. But ladies and gentlemen, would you thank the delightful Zoe Wanamaker?
Here we go.
One step.
Thank you very much.